Welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. The Republican National Convention did not come to Florida like planned 2 months ago. Instead of in Jacksonville, President Trump was on the South Lawn of the White House accepting the GOP presidential nomination Thursday night. He pledged there would be a COVID-19 vaccine before the end of the year and a quick return to full employment.
That's right. The president also promised to ban so-called sanctuary cities, where local police may not cooperate with federal immigration authorities. Florida passed a law banning sanctuary cities last year, even though no city in Florida has actually officially declared itself a sanctuary.
Just some of the issues the president spoke about last night during his acceptance speech to be nominated for his second term, running for re-election. Later this hour, we'll talk about the reopening of Florida schools. First, though, taking a look at presidential politics as Republicans gear up, hoping to win Florida again in November. Your thoughts, 305-995-1800. Just a couple of months now before Election Day, early voting, vote-by-mail ballots, and, of course, then the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, Election Day. Your thoughts, 305-995-1800 statewide, or find us on Twitter at Florida Roundup.
That's right. Let us know your thoughts as we head into the next 60 days, the fall election cycle. Kelly Mallette is an RNC delegate and a board member with the Miami-Dade Republican Party, and she's on the line. Hi, Kelly. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Now, I'm told this is your fourth Republican convention. What was it like participating as a delegate this year in a time of pandemic when most everything was virtual?
Well, certainly it was disappointing not to be able to celebrate in person as we have in other conventions. But I think the decision was, President Trump made the decision, and I think the decision was really in the best interests of the country. Having said that, I watched every minute of the convention, and I watched it. I streamed it on online so that I wasn't interested in looking at commentary. I wanted to see the convention as I would if I were on the floor. So I watched it just live streamed and moment to moment. And I watched every minute. And as a delegate, there are moments when you're on the floor and you're cheering and you're excited. And there are some very moving moments. And I was able to experience all that from home.
Right. It certainly was a different viewing experience to watch both conventions in this time we're living through. Of course, the RNC was for a little bit of time coming to Jacksonville because the president initially pulled the convention out of Charlotte when they insisted on COVID protocols. Jacksonville told the campaign they could have a looser convention here, but eventually, as you said, the reality of the pandemic did put the kibosh on those plans. Now, you've praised what you call the president's America First agenda and his emphasis on law and order. That's certainly a message that's resonating with some voters. Here in Florida, former Vice President Joe Biden is up several points over President Trump as we head into the fall cycle. What do you think the president should say to independent or undecided voters in this state who might be leaning toward the Biden-Harris ticket? Polls show they've been unhappy with the president's response to the coronavirus pandemic and his often divisive rhetoric as well. What's your response?
So first of all, I think the president did an excellent job in his speech last night discussing the steps that he took early on in the pandemic, and of course, discussing the administration's efforts related to a treatment and ultimately a vaccine. I think that's really helpful. I also think as it relates to independents and others, what the president needs to do is continue to, number one, focus on his America First agenda. But I think what we learned in this convention was this is a president who gets results. And I think we heard that from all walks of life.
Well, what are those results? I mean, there are 10,000 people dead in Florida of coronavirus alone. We're in a recession. Unemployment is way up. Things aren't good in this country right now. How is that a winning message in a presidential reelect?
Well, I think there was an acknowledgement from the president that, and from other speakers at the convention, that the pandemic has certainly changed what was a roaring economy prior to the pandemic. I think there was a clear message that prior to the pandemic, there was certainly a change in jobs. Look at speakers that from dairy farmers to lobstermen to loggers to truckers to people who have metal shops or metalworking businesses. I think if you look, small business owners, I think if you look at those people, they would tell you that the president has made a tremendous difference in improving jobs and the economy, of course, prior to the pandemic. As it relates to the pandemic, I think that the steps taken by Florida and as well as the administration has been to, number one, protect the vulnerable, which I think is a key and critical message. We've certainly done better than other states in terms of protecting the vulnerable.
How so? How do you mean?
I mean that by limiting exposures to long-term care patients, we've done better than other states. And I think we heard the president in his address last night talk about Florida's, talk about the country's mortality rate being fewer than lots of other places around the world. And that's certainly, we're pioneering treatments, we're pioneering in the area of a vaccine and are hopeful, of course, to have it soon. I think that the public looks at that and says there is some hope on the horizon in terms of getting past this pandemic. And once we do, who is the best person to have in place in terms of restoring the economy and the jobs that were in place prior to the pandemic?
Let's go to some calls now as we talk about the RNC this week. It's 305-995-1800. Scott is on the line from Orange Park. Scott, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Melissa. Just a couple of things. First, Republicans stand with, even when they know their candidate is lying, even though when they know that they're destructive, they stay loyal. They're oblivious to facts. In 2016, the Democrats turned their back on the DNC and the candidate because of the disenfranchisement that happened to Sanders. And that kind of like tunnel vision that they have is a danger. It is what supports despotism. If Trump was so great at building the economy, he inherited a great economy. He raised the deficit by 70% before COVID ever hit. So their whole narrative, if you confront it with facts, if you confront it with the record, falls apart. And Republicans don't care. You talk to them, and they come up with red herrings. You know, what about Obama? And it's like, I think they're ludicrous. I think.
All right, Scott. I get you. And that's Scott in Orange Park. So, Kelly Mallett, you know, you mentioned the economy a moment ago. But the truth of the matter is, for all of us, this election is a referendum on the incumbent. Elections always are. Critics of the president have said that he mismanaged the pandemic, which is why we are in dire economic straits right now. So how do you get a positive message across to voters in Florida as they weigh their ballot in this situation that we're in at this time in America?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that everyone agrees with your statement that the president mismanaged the pandemic. I don't think that's something that necessarily
he was given multiple briefings that the virus was coming here. He dithered. There's no national contact tracing and testing program. There hasn't been since the start.
And he immediately stopped travel from China when he was taking criticism from Democrats about having done so, saving probably countless lives. We'll never know the true total. That was decisive action which he was criticized for. I think in terms of testing, he certainly mobilized an enormous testing effort. Certainly states have a role to play in this pandemic. Each state makes in a republic, that's the way it works, right? States have some authority to do that and make some decisions, but he's mobilized testing efforts. He's mobilized personal protective equipment. He brought in reinforcements to New York. I think there's a number of things that he did that were decisive and that were to improve the situation as it relates to the pandemic. Certainly, you can't forget about the stimulus that they passed, the Paycheck Protection Program, and the other forms of support to small businesses and to folks who were suffering as a result.
Well, I want to thank you as we continue our conversation with delegates around the state for sharing your thoughts. Kelly Mallette is an RNC delegate and a board member of the Miami-Dade Republican Party. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
305-995-1800, talking across Florida about the Republican National Convention, wrapping up last night with the president's acceptance speech for his nomination for re-election, to run for re-election there on the south lawn of the White House. 305-995-1800. Sheila Griffin is with us, an RNC delegate, secretary of the Pinellas County Republican Party. Sheila, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time today.
Oh, it's my joy. What a pleasure.
Some South Florida delegates, great to have you on the program. South Florida delegates were telling me earlier in the week they wanted this convention to showcase the president's accomplishments. Do you think the convention executed on that?
I think it did very well, not only the accomplishments, I think it was impact. Accomplishments just list the things that you said you would do. And yes, promises made, promises kept. That's a theme that has run throughout his tenure. But however, I think what we saw was the impact on lives. And that was much more than just the writing or scripting of executive orders or making decisions that would save lives in America.
Which specific policies, which specific promises and delivery do you think resonated, particularly with Florida NPA voters, the swing voters, the non-affiliated voters with neither the Republican or the Democratic parties?
I think many of the things that were done, especially for African Americans, are hot. There's just never been a precedent that from the day he walked in began to change the economic lives of African Americans in a nation like Donald Trump. What he did regarding the Affordable Care Act and returning or eliminating the penalty returned money to our pockets. $1,200 or more earned income credit for each family, somewhere between $1,221 returned money to our pocket. Immediately making HBCUs infrastructure and innovation grants to return immediately enormous amounts of care. Opportunity zones, making sure that we had some interesting things related to Israel. When you're looking at Republican Party, most time what we never see and what people don't talk about is compassion. They'll talk about economics, they'll talk about lower taxes and things like that. But what was on display at this convention is how policies actually are compassionate. That if you have effective policies, people are impacted in ways that you never imagine.
Sheila, let me ask you about economic policies, particularly as it relates to Black Americans. The unemployment rate for Black Americans is still about twice as high as what it is for white Americans. Both of those unemployment rates have skyrocketed because of the COVID pandemic and some of the public health measures put into place. So the gap between unemployed Black Americans and unemployed white Americans nationwide has not necessarily narrowed under the Trump administration.
I really love the way that you're clustering that as a post-pandemic number. Because
To the pandemic, Sheila, the Black unemployment rate was about twice that of the white unemployment rate, even in January and February.
I have the numbers here, and they were dropping like crazy because it was the first time that we saw the lowest unemployment rate moving for African Americans.
Right. That's true, but the gap, but it was still, that is true. It was the lowest prior to the pandemic.
Remember, how you got to those rates was prior to the incumbent. So whenever you're looking at numbers and whenever I'm looking at numbers, I'm measuring because I don't want to support something that's a lie. I want to support something that I can actually prove as the president of the Black Republican Club. And so what I did was I started following the numbers and the number of people, not just jobs, the types of jobs, not just whether it was types of jobs, but the types of income. And so what I was able to look at is whether there was a significant improvement in the lives of people. I was working with felons coming home and getting them jobs. It got to be so interesting because at first I couldn't get jobs for any. There weren't any jobs. And by the time the third year hit, we had almost, I was down to approximately 10% of people I couldn't get jobs for felonies. This is significant.
So that was your Rolodex. Let me ask you, you mentioned about income. Pinellas County wages since 2016, according to Florida data and the Bureau of Labor Statistics, up about 10%. So the average wage in Pinellas County, where you live, is up about 10%. Statewide, Florida average wages are up 33%. During that same time period. Pinellas County has not kept pace with overall Florida in the last 3.5 years. Why not, do you think?
I'm not sure about that, and I'm not sure about the numbers at all. I do want to
Well, those numbers are online at the Florida Jobs.
No, I'm not challenging your numbers. I'm trying to respond to your question.
Gotcha.
What I'm telling you my level of ignorance concerning your representation. So if you say to me that we are at 10%, nevertheless, we are keeping pace on housing or we're keeping pace on the numbers of unemployment and things like that. That means that it's market-driven. That does not mean that it has anything to do with our national policy. So the market-driven part of our economy is directly tied to its nature. If we can increase the level of our population that are in healthcare, technology, we will automatically see increases in those numbers. But that's not how our market is driven. We're driven tourist-heavy and some manufacturing.
Sheila, let's take some phone calls here. We're speaking with Sheila Griffin, RNC delegate, Secretary of the Pinellas County Republican Party. David in Fort Lauderdale wants to join our conversation. Go ahead, David. You're on the radio.
Good afternoon. Hi, Sheila. Thank you very much for joining the conversation. It's really important to hear from the Black community, especially out of Pinellas, where my grandparents live. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, David.
More importantly, I voted for Trump last election, and I'm more concerned with the rhetoric and the attitudes that we see in representation of the administration when it does come to Black Lives Matter. And it's important to me from a mixed family, understanding the importance of the administration, realizing the importance of what the Black community puts out and provides, and how everything from law enforcement through just getting jobs have affected us under this administration. So I find it somewhat interesting as a Black woman to hear your support for Trump in reference to a lot of the issues that the Black Lives Matter community has felt very strongly about in reference to that administration. How do you feel, short of being a representative of the RNC, as a
David,
Black woman living in Florida primarily, your safety, your issues, how's your grandkids, how's your family look?
David, I'm going to interrupt here because we have less than a minute left, and I want to give Sheila just a quick opportunity. Unfortunately, short on time here, Sheila, but go ahead.
I believe in the message that all people matter, that Black lives matter, that Christ matter, that certain things in life right now are under attack and that we need to preserve them and make sure that we highlight the message. I do not necessarily believe in the messenger. I do not believe in Marxism. I do not believe in socialism or communism.
By the messenger, do you include the president in that, Sheila?
No, I include Black Lives Matter in that. He directed.
Understood. Okay.
Black Lives
Sorry
Matter.
For the interruption,
so,
Sheila. I can't
believe in the messenger.
I can't stop time,
message.
Sheila. We're coming up against a hard break, but I do appreciate your time today, and best of health to you. Sheila Griffin, RNC delegate, Secretary of the Pinellas County GOP, with us.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Florida teachers won in court this week, even as more school districts returned to the classroom. A judge ruled the state order to reopen brick-and-mortar schools by August 31st or lose funding was unconstitutional. The Florida Education Association filed a lawsuit after the state ordered teachers back to class 5 days a week despite the COVID pandemic. The state says it will appeal the ruling. So let's move on and talk about education. Has your school district reopened? Parents, teachers, students, what has the experience been like? Maybe you're on lunch break right now as you've gone back to school. If your school is getting ready to reopen, how are you prepared to head back to the classroom, or Maybe log on from home, 305-995-1800. Statewide phone number, 305-995-1800. And comments, questions on Twitter, at Florida Roundup.
Rob Creed is president of the Hillsborough Classroom Teachers Association, and he joins us now. Hi, Rob. What's your reaction to the judge's ruling?
Well, right now we're pretty excited that he's realizing that, hey, it's a huge government overreach by basically dictating conditions and the approval of plans and threatening financial consequences to districts across the state if they don't follow exactly what they believe is in the emergency order, and trying to decide what every local needs to do. So we're pretty excited that we're in a good spot and that the judge is ruling in our favor as of right now.
And so the judge essentially sided with Florida teachers, saying that they should not be forced to go back into classrooms 5 days a week if they fear for their health and safety. Of course, the DeSantis administration is appealing this ruling, so there's a stay for now. What's the next move for your teachers' association? We don't anticipate any immediate changes in the classroom situation where you are in Hillsborough County or really anywhere in the state while this is litigated.
Yeah, and right now our teachers are finishing up their very first week of school, which we're calling Smart Start Week because everyone has done it in an intelligent manner by doing it through e-learning. Our numbers for COVID cases were really off the chart several weeks ago in Hillsborough. So our decision was that we would do this for an entire month. And Commissioner Corcoran.
The Education Commissioner, right.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, yes. Saying that he was going to withhold financial, you know, funds from our schools if we were to go beyond this week with e-learning. So the case we feel really helps us with what we want to do. But as of right now, our school board is planning to send our teachers, students back to brick and mortar for those that are choosing, and e-learning for those that choose that starting Monday.
And how are you with that? What's your association's response to that move?
Well, overall, we're concerned about the safety of the students. We're concerned about the safety of the employees. I mean, we could do several things with hand sanitizer and masks, which do help, but we're putting people and a lot of kids into buildings that are not built for social distancing. As a matter of fact, I would argue that schools are built for the exact opposite of that. We want kids to be working together, collaborating. So we have real challenges in keeping people apart, at least 6 feet apart. So there is huge concern that we'll see outbreaks almost immediately in our schools.
It's 305-995-1800 as we talk about the fall school year, or the fall term, I should say, around Florida. Let us know how you feel about your child's educational situation. Now, let me ask you as well, what's your response to parents who disagree with the Florida Education Association? They approved of the state's mandate to reopen schools. They want the option for their kids to attend class in person. What do you say to those parents?
I would tell parents and anyone that we firmly agree that we want all of our kids and teachers back in our buildings. I mean, that is the best way to teach young people. I mean, we know, and I've been a classroom teacher for over 24 years before I've been serving in this role, that in our classrooms and in our schools, the number one goal is to keep the kids safe. When the kids are safe, then you show the kids that you care about them, and that's when you can actually move them in terms of their learning gains. So you can't have one without the other. So we start with safety, and that's really what this is all about. And the lawsuit's not necessarily about opening schools or keeping schools closed. It's really about local control. If the numbers are really high in Hillsborough, we believe that we have the right to say that school A, B, or C can close based upon those numbers. But as of the emergency order, we would not have that ability. The governor would have to sign off on where and how we would go about that. And once again, we just disagree with that government type of overreach and telling us how we need to operate with our schools.
Now, at the same time, I know you've heard from quite a few teachers looking to retire or resign over the back-to-class mandate. They're just concerned about contracting COVID, particularly senior citizen teachers, teachers in their 60s. What are the teachers saying to you this week?
Well, there's frustration about those teachers that believe that they should have an option as well that don't. I mean, the Commissioner of Education came out early on and said that parents and teachers would have choices. But it seems that only the parents have those choices. teachers have to make the choice based upon what the parents are asking for. So in our district, for example, we have many teachers that are going back that are medically sensitive to some of the, to dealing with COVID, and they're being forced to go back or take a leave of absence or even resign from their job that they love so much because of the fear of COVID. So there's a genuine concern that we're not going to have enough quality teachers in Florida to even meet the needs of the students that are even going back to brick and mortar. We're kind of making a problem that we've had over the past couple of years a lot worse by kind of funneling and forcing people back.
I want to thank you for dropping in with us as the school year gets into full swing. He's Rob Crete, president of the Hillsborough Classroom Teachers Association. Thanks, Rob.
305-995-1800, our statewide phone number. Share your experiences about going back to the classroom, logging online as the another school year gets underway, unlike any other school year in anyone's lifetime. 305-995-1800. Martin County Schools, just north of Palm Beach County, reopened August 11th with a choice between remote learning and classroom learning. More than 450 students and staff at nine schools have been moved out of their buildings because testing positive for the virus or in close contact with someone who has tested positive. Kelly Haddix is with us via FaceTime audio, the Martin County Education Association Executive Board member. Kelly, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation to be with you today.
So a few weeks in, 450 students and staff at nine schools moved. How would you describe the first few weeks of back to the classroom learning in Martin County?
Oh, wow. You're right. Over 400 students. Our teachers are frightened, anxious. They cry on their way to work. They're very concerned, obviously. And while I was preparing just for this interview and just the half hour before you had me on, I started getting texts that yet another school, just in the last half hour, 19 more students and three more teachers quarantined at our local high school. It's never ending. People are scared for their safety, for the students, for the staff, for themselves. Unfortunately, we are seeing exactly what we've already seen and are still continuing to see what your last speaker fears.
Yeah. Kelly, you helped negotiate the school district's reopening plan, the plan that was put. You're laughing. Why are you laughing at that?
There was no negotiation. No negotiation really occurred, not good faith anyway. I was on the task force.
So no negotiation. Really characterize then the conversations around it. Take us inside that room in the weeks before August 11th as Martin County school administrators, the school board, and the teachers union, represented by yourself and others, discussed what reopening in the pandemic was going to be like.
I think that's been one of MCA's biggest disappointments in this whole process. There wasn't a collaborative process. We weren't invited to the table until the very last minute. By then, it made it extremely difficult to give, you know, meaningful insight and to be a part of that dialogue. We were told at the last minute that it was painfully apparent that all the decisions had already been made. They really weren't looking for you know, insight and meaningful options.
So are you satisfied with us. How the district has handled it when someone tests positive? You mentioned just getting a text message here in the last hour
no.
or so.
Yeah.
You're not satisfied with
no.
that?
No, I'm not satisfied at all. I'm not sure how much time we have here. We were also, at least I think, I could be incorrect, but as far as I'm aware, we are also, Martin County is the only county that has deemed their teachers to be essential workers. And that means that once our teachers are exposed, unless and until they test positive or they're symptomatic, they're expected to be back in school. We know from doctors, we know from researchers that is the time you're most contagious after exposure before you're symptomatic, putting those people back in schools.
Kelly, are you teaching this year in Martin County?
No. The reason I have the privilege of speaking with you today is I was forced out on an unpaid leave.
What do you mean by forced out?
I would reiterate what your last speaker said, that, and this is a quote, and this is just from this week, where the commissioner said, quote, "The fight has been and will continue to be about giving every parent, every teacher, emphasis on that, and every student a choice regardless of what educational option they chose." I wasn't given an option. 300 plus teachers in Martin County that are high risk or that are living or caring for a high risk individual like I am were not given an option. Our options were retire, resign, or go out on leave.
And you chose to go out on an unpaid leave.
I'm out on an unpaid leave, yes.
How has that affected any other benefits that you may have had as a teacher? I'm thinking about retirement. I'm thinking about health care coverage, those types of...
Yeah. Well, fortunately, on FMLA, the district is required to continue to pay their portion of my health care.
That's the Family Medical Leave Act, federal law.
Yes, but I'm unpaid. I'm getting absolutely no salary. I'm extremely concerned. We went back 4 weeks ago, so I've got 8 weeks left. And unless the Martin County School District provides me the option that the commissioner says I'm being provided, I'm going to be out of job in 8 weeks. I'm not going to be able to practice my profession anymore.
And what choices are you having to make between now and in 8 weeks as you learn that fate?
Well, my personal situation is my husband suffers from a progressive neurodegenerative disease. He has a very rare brain disease that has no treatment or cure. And our physician, who is the director of the Movement Disorder Clinic at the University of Florida, Sheehan's, has told us in no uncertain terms that my husband cannot survive coronavirus. So we have essentially been isolated since mid-March. So we're doing the best that we can, but I certainly believed and had hoped, given the numbers in Martin County, which is a story in and of itself, that people that were myself and people that are similarly situated would have been afforded an option to teach remotely. We have over 30% of our kids right now, of our students, learning remotely, but teachers were not provided an opportunity to teach them.
Kelly Haddock's with us via FaceTime audio. She is the Martin County Education Association Executive Board member. Kelly, thanks for joining us here on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Well, students and teachers in Orange County, including Orlando, are finishing up their third week of school. The first 2 weeks were online, and about 30% of students in Central Florida there returned to school buildings this week. Rob Paschal is the Orange County Public Schools Teacher of the Year for 2019-2020, and he's a finalist for the 2021 Florida Teacher of the Year. Hi, Rob.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you, and kudos on your accomplishments in the classroom. So what have the first few weeks of class been like for you and your students?
Thank you. The first few weeks have been a little bit bumpy. As you mentioned, the first 9 days were virtual learning only. That gave us a chance to try out a couple of platforms and internet connectivity. We began face-to-face instruction last Friday.
You teach fifth grade, so you've got students who are socially distancing, wearing masks. You're teaching, I would guess, some in person, some virtually. How do you balance and manage all that? How does that add to your burden as a teacher? And again, you are the Orange County Teacher of the Year for last year, so you're doing a good job. But this has added a lot of wrinkles to your job.
It has. There's certainly been some more time that's been needed to dedicate to preparing lessons that can be accessed with my face-to-face students, as well as my 13 scholars that remain at home on the Launch Ed program that we have. We have our learning management system that allows us to continue to have conversations. In the classroom, I have 5 students that are with me. We are all 8 to 10 feet apart. We all wear our masks at all day, the entire time. So we're still working through a couple of kinks, but I think that the thing I'm most excited about is so many educators sharing so many ideas with each other to help each other.
And what are some of those ideas? How are teachers helping each other right now through this time?
One example is with the learning management system that we have, being able to have video conferencing with our scholars at home. One of the teachers on my team said, hey, you know what? If you log into a second computer at the same time, you can actually, you won't overload your laptop, which is using the video conferencing portion of the platform. And with the second computer, you can actually drive and present from that computer. Those types of things, those types of ideas, those types of strategies, those types of try this has really streamlined this process.
Let's take a quick call. It's Lou in Orlando. Hi, Lou. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning or good afternoon. Sorry. I've been delivering food volunteering in Orange County. Congratulations to your guest. That's the Teacher of the Year.
And we're a minute from a break. Go ahead quickly, Lou.
Okay, real quick. What I'm coming across is the first couple of months, the people were really desperate because they lost their jobs. Now the black and brown people are getting their minimum wage jobs back, but they can't afford to put their kids in daycare. They relied on the school system.
I hear you saying you feel like schools need to be open for those families. And I don't mean to cut you off, Lou, but we're really tight on time. So, Rob Pascal, your answer to those families who want brick-and-mortar schools open for these reasons.
Orange County has provided options for our families to either be in brick-and-mortar option or to be at home. We've asked families to make a commitment for the first 9 weeks and then to reevaluate that after that time.
And so this is such an extraordinary time. And as Lou said, people are unemployed. People are struggling. I want to thank you, Rob, for your service to students. He's Rob Pascal, the Orange County Public Schools Teacher of the Year last year and a finalist for the award this year. Rob, thanks for giving us a few moments here on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you, Melissa. Have a good day.
And in a moment, Florida colleges and universities go back to class too, but with a warning for students to behave themselves. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Stay with us.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. As we talk about the return to class, whether it's K through 12 or higher ed, we want to hear from you. It's 305-995-1800 to call us up here on the Florida Roundup. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup. We see your tweets out there. Lots of memes coming into the show. We can't always read those on the air, but we are seeing them. So thanks for interacting with us. All right, so Florida's colleges and universities have also begun their academic year, but they're warning students to follow restrictions to keep campuses safe from COVID outbreaks, Tom. They're being really sternly talked to right now by college administrators.
Yeah, young adults, teenagers on campus, maybe for the first time, or returning to campus, sometimes not always known to follow each and every rule, certainly, in the best of times. And now during this pandemic, we're seeing some of those stern statements coming from universities and colleges across Florida as students and teachers, faculty back at work. Susan Evans is the Vice President and Chief of Staff at Florida Gulf Coast University, and she joins us now. Susan, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time today.
Good afternoon, Melissa and Tom. It's nice to be with you.
Great to have you, too. Classes at GCU started a couple of weeks ago. The university has reported 8 student cases of COVID-19 through Tuesday. Is that still accurate?
Yes. Well, actually, a little bit more. We have, in the first 2 weeks, had 12 cases, 11 students. And one employee since we opened 2 weeks ago.
What can you tell us about those cases, and what do you know about the source of the infection, and what's the university doing around contact tracing around those students and faculty member who have been infected?
Well, fortunately, the number is low, as I said, and they're all unrelated cases. So we have been spared to date the cluster kinds of cases that we're all reading about in the media. Excuse me. We put together, and we have been working for literally months now, trying to get the campus ready for the start of a semester unlike any other we've seen before, and hope to never see again. But we have put a lot of things in place. One thing, specific to your question, is complementary to the Florida Department of Health contact tracing. So we have put a system in place, our case management system for the campus. It includes five case investigators and an epidemiologist working with our student health services as well. Mm-hmm. So what we have done is try and find out when students have been tested, whether through us or an off-site location, find out when they've received a positive result or if they've been around someone who is positive and they may have been exposed.
So are you requiring regular testing? Are you requiring any regular testing of students and faculty?
No, we're not requiring it. We are strongly encouraging it and working on that basis.
And for those 11 students who have tested positive since the beginning of the semester, what type of quarantine situation does the university offer? Or if they live off campus, what kind of protocols can be involved?
Right. Well, if they live on campus, they can go into a set-aside quarantine dorm that we have, or they can return home if they wish.
And how, of the 11 students, how many of them remain?
Well, some of those have gone through now. They're just coming off their isolation period.
I see.
If they were ones, you know, from the first of those 2 weeks. So off the top of my head, I would say about half of them are still in isolation.
Susan Evans is with us, the Vice President and Chief of Staff at Florida Gulf Coast University. Classes began at GCU a couple of weeks ago. 305-995-1800, FSU students, UF students, FIU, FAU, UNF, Florida universities, colleges are going back, certainly. This week, Susan, the university sent a note to students after reports of a couple of fraternities holding large off-campus parties a week ago tonight. Students reportedly weren't wearing face coverings. They were not keeping their distance from each other. And the organizations were put on suspension. And the university said the parties, quote, put us at risk of having to close the campus. What would trigger you to close GCU in the middle of a semester?
Well, it would be similar to the spring semester if we had to make a decision to move to all remote and virtual instruction if there were to be an outbreak of cases. And that's what President Martin was referring to.
Yeah. Is there a threshold that you have in mind in terms of the number of cases or an infection rate?
We're doing that on looking at that on a case-by-case basis. So far, as I said, our numbers are low. We want to keep it that way.
It's Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Question for you. You know, college students are being supervised loosely. The whole concept of in loco parentis. It's an age when they're legally adults, but socially they're really not quite there yet. What are some of the special challenges of managing this student population when they are so eager to party and congregate and enjoy the full flavor of the college experience? And they're not always mature enough to make good decisions, and they're away from their parents for the first time. I would think that is a really tough nut to crack for college administrators right now. What's the toughest thing about this?
I think the toughest thing, Melissa, is the fact that this pandemic, this COVID-19, is a disease or an illness, I should say, that someone can have and have no symptoms, show no symptoms, and yet be positive and can infect others. And as a result of that, it's very challenging to let, as you said, young people really understand and help them understand that they could be contributing to something that could curtail our semester and their campus experience that they wanted.
Yeah, it's hard to get people that age to understand that they're not necessarily invincible, right? At that age, you feel invincible. You just don't think you could get sick.
Exactly. And I think at first it was in the media portrayed as an illness, a virus that affected primarily older people. And so what we've tried to do and are continuing to do is try and educate the students, let them know that, yes, it can impact you. You can get COVID-19, and you can infect others you care about and other members of the campus community.
That's a message everyone needs to be reminded of. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
305-995-1800, our statewide phone number. Are you back on campus? Have you sent a child or loved one back to school, back to college or university in Florida, preparing for that? What has that experience been like? 305-995-1800. We're speaking with Susan Evans, Vice President, Chief of Staff at Florida Gulf Coast University. Susan, we've seen on social media, TikTok particularly, a video surface of college campus parties, dormitory parties, fraternity parties. How much monitoring is GCU doing of that kind of activity, or is the thought wait for those reports to come in?
No, we're very proactive in monitoring that. And surprisingly, in a positive way, the way we learned the information of the two fraternity parties you mentioned that were allegedly held last week, that came to us from students. So,
why do you say allegedly held last week? Have the facts not bore that out yet?
That's correct. They are on interim suspension, so there will be a review through our student code of conduct to determine the facts.
Do you think campuses could get tougher on students as the year goes on, Susan, if they continue to flout the restrictions? At Florida State, the college president there, John Thrasher, issued a really dire warning to the student body to stop defying the COVID measures that have been put in place on campus. Could sanctions get tougher on college campuses?
Absolutely. At this point, as you've seen, President Martin at FGCU sent a similar message, very direct, saying that there will be serious consequences for those who ignore the rules that would keep all of us safe on campus.
Up to and including expulsion from college?
We're looking at them on a case-by-case basis, but that is certainly an option if someone chooses to not follow the rules and not really be a part of our community. It's trying to keep a semester going in face of a pretty strong challenge.
Susan, we've seen how powerful peer-to-peer messaging is in this pandemic and elsewhere. Are you seeing any student organizations pop up on campus, any COVID campus student groups put together that may help in that message about social distancing and facial coverings and responsibility?
I haven't seen an organization yet, but our student leaders, including through student government, are doing a tremendous job helping us with this. Because as you say, peer-to-peer pressure and encouragement, we think, is where the answer lies.
It's so fascinating to hear, you know, from K through 12 educators, Tom, and now college administrators like Susan, about how they're dealing with this. If there's one thing we've all learned, it's how important it is to be flexible and to listen to the scientists and the data that's coming in, and to be mindful of the emotions that are being experienced. And I'm sure it's just a heightened time on college campuses right now, Susan. You know, it's always heightened for new students, and this is really quite a year for them to be either starting or completing college in the middle of a global pandemic. So I want to thank you so much for educating all of us all over the state about what's happening. Thank you so much for joining the Florida Roundup.
Thank you for having me. We appreciate it, and wish all of the universities and K-12 systems good luck as they continue in a very challenging time.
That's right. Susan Evans with us, VP Chief of Staff at FGCU Florida Gulf Coast University. Wow, what a week it's been. Well, that's our show. Thanks for listening to the Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jax, WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are the producers.
Jason Zapka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming. The Director of Radio Operations in Miami is Peter Meritz. He's also our Technical Director. We get engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Brady Corum. Chris Remington answered the phones, and our theme music comes from Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll be back next Friday at noon.